dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast from a parallel universe where every beloved Doctor Who classic is in reality just terribly tiresome. I'm Nathan.
I'm Brendan.
And I'm a complimentary tray of WD-40 scented spumanti for this one, since I'm in the kitchen again. Hi, folks.
Well, the entire time vortex has collapsed and we've landed in a dystopian version of Britain where the bewildered populace are skulking in the streets while the toffs are sailing around in Zeppelins, drinking champagne and generally enjoying Brexit. Thank God, really, for the rise of the Cybermen. So, can we all agree that Roger Lloyd Pack is really terrible in this?
No. I can never decide whether I like him or not, but I think I fall on the side of liking him.
I appreciate his amoral disdain for the audience. I appreciate that he is seeing us all as some panto hoopla, sticky children, and he's just throwing us a whole lot of really look. It actually, it's Barnum and Bailey. It's just, or you know, any vaudeville old act, and I think Doctor Who does vaudeville beautifully. So really, he's the celestial toy maker.
It's really weird to go from sort of scenes where you've got Billy and Noel and David Tennant kind of doing sort of proper, you know, emotional acting, and then you go to Roger Lloyd Pack and his little friend.
Well, this is something I was going to bring up later. Are they, or is it actually that Billy and Noel are really giving us Fabe, and this is no denigration because we all know how good these shows can actually be, Fabe Corrie realism, or wherever, whatever the Welsh equivalent is. And then we've got Tennant doing his Dick Van Dyke shtick, which is canon because it's named in the actual program.
Yes.
And I think, I'm wondering if Roger, who is a great funny bloke and a proper comedian and loved by everyone in the industry for being a genuine wit and dry and super smart on set. So I'm sure, not having seen the yet, I'm sure the gentle listener has watched the commentary, but I haven't seen Tennant's one. But I know that those two would have been sparring off each other. So I actually think Roger might be picking up on Tennant's acting style, which I'll be talking about throughout the podcast.
Yes, a friend of the podcast, Fiona Tomney, was complaining about his general face pulling and bizarre behaviour.
And she works with horses, so she knows what that's all about. You could stick a bridle in that thing and it'll still be gurning away.
Yes, quite. Oh, dear. He does seem, you know, he is sort of a low-rent version of Davros, isn't he? Like, he's disabled.
David Tennant, absolutely.
He's disabled, which is obviously unfortunate.
No one can be as camp as Davros.
No. Well, I mean, you compare him to Davros, and Davros has
neither.
Well, he has neither, but he has the range, doesn't he, darling? He really has the range. So he goes from shouty to being sort of quite quiet to being thoughtful. It's a really impressive performance from Michael Wisher.
I agree. But no, look, Lloyd Pack is definitely pantoing this. I think he's seeing it as a kiddie show. But yeah. I do honestly believe he's getting that from David's performance, which is quite hypertrophied and sticky. It does feel quite Disney-fied. And watching the sensitive scenes, he at least... Well, I was going to say, he can't bowdlerize those moments between Noel and Billy. That I'm still sticking with the first episode when they're realizing they're going down because the camera's not on him. When you look at it, the emotional moments work when Tennant's face isn't tenanting in the room. I loved him at the time, but I'm getting a real sense of you're acting a lot here, aren't you?
Yeah.
Whereas the others are giving, I would say, a performance that I can feel.
We actually talked about this at the end of last week's episode because he's devastated by the death of Renette at the end of The Girl in the Fireplace.
And so much so that he dated her for a little while.
He did, yes. He comes into the TARDIS and he's really somber and he's absolutely not doing the Doctor Who acting thing that he does.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful.
It was a nice change, wasn't it?
I think that Tennant does try to delineate between the, you know, Dick Van Dyke apples and pears chutney and cheese, whatever. And there's a scene where that
Iron Hoof
really comes to the fore in this episode, where, you know, he's just done the bit with the crystal with Mickey, which is full blown Dick Van Dyke, yeah. You know. Just wasted 10 minutes of my life.
I like that.
Worth every second. I really like it as well. And then he comes to Rose and say, oh, look, I fixed it. We'll be going home soon, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, Rose has just researched Pete and Tennant's face falls. He's like, what is it? It's the total switch between grinning idiot to, did you do the thing? I told you not to do that. Did you do the thing? Okay. And then you've got Mickey going off in one direction, Rose going off in the other. And
am I having Salford withdrawal syndrome? Am I having Eccles withdrawal?
Oh well, God, I'm still having Eccles withdrawal.
I'm picturing Eccles watching these again. I'd love to know what the lovely Liz Miles and Stevens have said in earlier episodes of the podcast, which are available to download from your choice of Nathanisms. That, you know, how everyone else has been taking it, because I'm still seeing asking myself what would Eccles do. He'd be amazing in this one.
I'm pretty sure that the girl in the fireplace started development with Eccleston, and that was part of the dichotomy there, that you had the rough Salford lad and the aristocratic mistress of the King of France.
I was Lady Penelope, you know.
Best thing about
not
that
just movie. Nobody.
Tennant's interesting because, this is the first podcast I've done on a Tennant story, isn't it? Tennant's interesting because when I look back on the era, I feel he's the weakest of the new series Doctors. But then I actually go back and watch them as like, actually, it's really hard for me to fault you.
He's also got the best stories.
I agree. I think I feel the same way. I always kind of expect to be slightly irritated by him, but you go back and watch an episode and you are slightly irritated by him. But it's very clear why he is one of the best remembered new series Doctors.
Because he had Graham Harper.
Well, Graham Harper and Russell T. Davies as well. These are great seasons of Doctor Who.
Which brings up my question. It does. Is his own 2IC NIDA actually Graham Harper in apotheosis in this episode? Because the casting, the bloke, I know the actor, I'm trying to think who he is. He looks just like Graham Harper.
Colin Spall.
That's it, Colin Spall. And who he even sounds like Graham.
He is in Revelation of the Daleks. He's Lilt, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Also, he and Graham went to school together. They've known each other since they were 10 or 11.
Yeah.
He's doing it now.
Yeah. And
so he's cast him as well. So we have Graham Harper, and he does, I think, 4 episodes this season.
That's right. He does these 2 and he does the finale.
Yeah.
And these were all part of the one block. It took them 3 months to film the episodes.
They exhausted the elderly gentleman, didn't they?
Yes.
I think to the point that he said, I'm getting on bit for this.
Well, he was very famous, I think, in his 2 classic stories of being super, super active and kind of running around. He was one of the people.
In that silicon suit, wasn't he? He was doing the whole dance moves for Sarah's Jack and everything.
But he would direct from the floor. And we said, I think at the time in our episode on Caves of Androzani, that it was an astonishingly well-directed story and vastly, vastly better than everything that surrounded it and really, really stylish. Now he's slightly older. It's still, I think, very well-directed, but not as markedly well-directed, because all the other directors in the era are very good as well.
And visual tropes have – what did we just say? Visual conceits have caught up as well. But I actually get that this is a nice traditional way of directing a program. Although there's those lovely vistas. I actually felt it was a little bit Disney and Rocketeer. Mm. We'll get onto the Cyberman designs in a bit, but the way it was shot was definitely filmic. And also it felt very much like some of my favourite World War II British films, and his shooting of the dirigibles, of the airships, was very much like Sir Carol Reed's shooting in his war biopics, which are my possibly pick of the week.
So let's talk about the parallel universe. the parallel universe is kind of stolen a bit from Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
It really is, isn't it?
So,
in a good way.
And Philip Pullman actually, I think, writes the introduction to The Writer's Tale and talks about being ripped off. And so, and you know, in an, in an admiring way, you know, so the parallel universe where there are zeppelins is the universe from The Golden Compass, which is also called Northern Lights.
Yes, it's the His Dark Materials triptych, and he's brought out another one. I've got all four of them. Another one's coming out. Oh, there's so many picks of the week.
They're really great. I mean, if they don't come up as picks of the week in next week's episode, then you
I'll
really
be astonished or forgetful.
Yeah, exactly. One of those. It is incredible, and it's where that image of the two people trapped on either side of a barrier between parallel universes comes from. So the two leads end up being split up and unable to get to each other's universe, and they meet in Oxford and sit on the same park bench but in different universes. And we will talk about that at the end of the season because,
yes,
you know, it's a huge – a huge image and one of the most memorable scenes, I think, in modern Who.
That's a lovely presage because we get that moment with a wall, don't we? I'm remembering.
Yeah.
A friend of mine's just had chemo, which didn't work, and he's now, because none of us are getting any younger. It's all right, there's a light end to this. That didn't work, so they now use this really super version of radiation therapy, which would be the sort of thing that Roger Lloyd-Pack's character had been having here. No, it's true, and the walking thing is all very difficult, but there are amazing results now with people who we were losing even just last year on this fabulous trial. But the nurse said to him after his first radiation treatment, now I'll take a picky of you, look at this. He had an aura and he glows. And she said, no, you can get a cab home. You've got to sit in the back seat and you can't share a sensitive moment with anyone, not even through a hole in a wall. She was 23. How does she know us so well? So I would actually note that to both Billy and David for the end of the year. So just be careful where you go with this.
Oh, God.
That's a plot for Star Wars.
So we've had a parallel universe before, and it was in Inferno.
Yeah, aren't we lucky we didn't accidentally end up in this one? It's like, oh, we've fallen out of things and we've ended up on a radioactive cinder floating around.
Bugger that.
Oh, there's Liz's wig.
No, I guess I want seven episodes and Billy in a Helen Shapiro black Motown wig. I want that.
But Nikki, I mean, with a moustache.
Yeah.
I think I've said before that Inferno is a bit overrated and it's extraordinary padding.
Gasp.
I think.
Well, we can't all be right.
No, that's true. I am wrong sometimes. I think L. Sandifer says that it's the most egregious padding in a Doctor Who episode because you have a bunch of episodes where they just redo the previous episodes again in a parallel universe. But the thing that the parallel universe does is gives actors at the end of the season the chance to camp it up and play different versions of themselves. And so here we've got Rose's family. We get wonderful Sean Dingwall back with less hair. You know, as a successful version of himself.
And I think attending a few fitness classes in the meantime.
Oh,
he's
do
looking,
you think?
He's looking well lickable in this one. Yes, yes.
Well, you know, he does do his health drinks.
No, but they're just pop. They don't actually work.
They're just pop. But the interesting thing about his health drinks is that Lumic has a line in his voiceover of how Cybus works that the brain will be suspended in a blend of patent chemicals.
Oh, you think it's Vitex?
I think this is why he's bought Vitex. Because, you know, you consider, you see all those videos, well, you know, here's what Coke can do to a coin, and it can clean things and it can preserve things and it can, you know, clean your loo and teach your children how to do algebra. I think the brain is suspended in Vitex drinks, and I think that was the joke at the time. And I remember laughing at that and my mum and dad going, what? Nothing.
It's copyrighted chemicals, isn't
exactly,
it? That's the line.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a sort of darkness to this too because the health drinks don't work. They're a fake.
Yeah.
And there's something about the world being sick. And I think that...
Yes, the Mark Platt spare parts.
Yeah. So Mark Platt gets a with thanks to Mark Platt credit here, even though spare parts is not very much like this story.
Indeed, but the original concept was that it would be not exactly an adaptation of Spare Parts, but draw on it more heavily. And the initial drafts by Tom McRae, who was kind of a protege of Russell T. Davis.
Right.
Do we know how he got the job? This isn't salacious. I had to say that because of a face. Richard,
just silent muays in the room. Yeah.
I
had a Maleficent moment.
Shortly after Queer as Folk, Russ Davies was doing a signing and Tom McRae turned up with a few spec scripts and sort of said, Russell, I think you're wonderful. Could you give me some feedback? And Russell did and sort of nurtured him from then on and, gave him this opportunity. He was 25 when he wrote these scripts. It was always a parallel universe, but it was going to be a parallel universe where there was a plague, and that's why people were going in for these upgrades. And Russell kind of thought, well, hold on, back in the 60s, it was all about, oh, if you replace things with prosthetics and whatnot, you'll become a Cyberman. And Russell's like, well, we have people who are amputees now who are experimenting with this thing and it's enriching their lives. It's not taking over them. Let's go for a different angle. And that's when they decided on the consumerism angle. Mm. And even then it was going to be people going in and getting their arms replaced as a fashion statement. And Russell went, oh, I think that's a bit far, but look at this new thing called an iPod.
Yeah.
And I think we were a few months away from the first iPhone, or a couple of years away from the first iPhone. So they decided to go down that angle instead. And that's why it moves away from Spare Parts so much. But Mark Platt did get a fee sort of for the ideas.
Right. Yeah. I also think that the world was going to be more dystopian than it ends up being. And I gather that they pulled back on it because that was where Rose and Jackie were going to end up at the end of the season.
Mm. Yeah.
So it couldn't be a sort of terrible world where everyone was sick and where there was, because there's a huge demarcation between rich and poor.
And they do talk about food queues, and they do talk about, you know, the absent, the lack of employment, and
curfews.
It's a little
curfews, heaps of homelessness.
It's a little bit April in 2019, isn't it, rather than April in Paris?
yeah. And in fact, it is amazingly prescient because, as you say, Brendan, the iPhone, I think, is announced in 2006 and comes out in 2007.
Is it that long ago? I thought I had one in 2000. Okay.
Yeah. And it didn't come out here in Australia until a year later.
Okay.
So you see the phones, like, Rose has a new phone for this story. She doesn't have her old little colourful Nokia. She does have a sort of upgraded phone. And it is funny seeing these people with what are called earpods, but look and function like AirPods, which you see people wearing all the time now. In fact, Apple does use the term earpods for the wired headphones that I'm actually currently wearing. They're called earpods.
And joke.
And the idea that we all sort of have this sort of similar experience, there's that scene, which I'm not sure quite comes off, where all these extras stop moving in the morning and everything gets downloaded to them, the news and the weather and stuff. And it just seems to me like Twitter, you know, like every day on Twitter, there's something that more or less everyone is talking about, something that there'll be, you know, a report in the newspaper a day later about, here's what we're talking about on Twitter today. And so there is this kind of cyber world that we're all sort of plugged into, and we all isolate ourselves by creating our own soundscapes, by not interacting with each other. Everyone on the bus is on their phone. And this is the new thing that we're anxious about. And we seem to be kind of, you know, anxious about it in anticipation, because it hasn't quite hit yet in 2006, but it is going to hit. And that's the Cyberman. And, you know, Kit Pedler's original idea doesn't work anymore as a conception of the Cyberman. And so we have a new reinvention of the Cyberman that works really well now. We use the term cyber now in a way that wasn't really current in 1960. And we have a parallel Earth instead of an upside down Earth that sort of wandered back into our orbit.
I'm sure that's Malaysia.
I love that line.
It's just a trick of the light, my dear, if I stand you the right way.
That's Norway. I do have a question, though, about the earpods, right, and the daily update. What the hell happens to bus drivers and crane operators and trapeze artists?
Bicyclists, like myself.
Yep.
Yes.
I mean, and if it's a matter of, oh, you know when the daily update's going to come, you pull over. Why is that person in the middle of the road? Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't, I mean, that doesn't really work, the all stopping thing, but it is a very sort of quick and handy kind of exposition scene.
The ear pods were, obviously not for the extras, but for the lead actors, were specially fitted, which didn't work, and they constantly kept falling out.
Right.
And you can see it most in that scene towards the end where Pete is talking to Rose about his marriage. Sean Dingwall sort of tries to keep his left ear mostly on camera because if he turns, you see the giant fluoro earplug that the ear pods are based on halfway out of his ear, and he's sort of angling his head and trying to will it back in. And according to Noel Clark, he's like, yeah, that's exactly what Sean Dingwall was doing. He's like, this is coming out. Can we get through the scene? Can we get? Oh, we did it. Okay.
It's the craft, my dear, the craft.
With sort of rigid plastic earphones, I don't know about anyone else, but if I smile with them, yeah, I can feel them shifting within my ear. And I'm sure that's what they can't take into account with these things is, yeah, when you move your mouth, which you occasionally do as an actor, it's going to make the ear pods sort of bounce up and down.
How did Billie Piper manage?
Well, she does wear them, but they're fake, you see. So
one grin from her and her ears pop.
And also they couldn't hear each other. The actors couldn't hear each other. So it's the Gene Wilder thing in Speak No Evil, Hear No Evil, or Hear No Evil, Speak No Evil, whatever that film is called. You know, the actors just have to look at each other and, okay, have you finished? No, sorry. You're still going. Okay. I love that scene at the party, you know, with Rose so angry that she has to serve people food.
Well, again,
she's
two weeks later.
She needs a bath.
I absolutely adore that scene. It's absolutely one of my favourite things. And it's when you hear Jackie calling for Rose, and I think it's clear a little bit too early that Rose must be a dog from the way that she keeps calling her, and then the little sort of horrible Yorkie comes in.
It was horrible Yorkie.
But the great thing is that Rose is about to go off on a sort of really soulful kind of angsty thing about how her mother in this universe doesn't love her or something, and then the dog turns up and Tennant just looks at her and bursts out laughing and completely kind of forestalls any sort of weepy nonsense that was about to take place. I think the scene where Jackie is horrible to Rose is really, really, it's really hard to watch.
I think it's superb. This is a real levelling moment. I was going to bring this up with the best thing about the Russell era is that you've said it many times, we care about the characters. Mm. And that's really what we've missed. We only really got it in seasons 10 and 11, we've had to wait this long.
Yeah.
This long. But the whole thing is that I really didn't care too much when this Jackie, well, that Jackie, disappeared into a rather fabulous Rocketeer Art Deco hood ornament suit at the end of the story.
Because she's horrible.
Well, it's just that I also really loved it. And that there's the subtleties and nuances of just this is a family and people are awful to each other just as much as they're not, just as much as they're loving. But I really like seeing them both together with a turn again so I could see it's such a nice bookend to Father's Day.
Yeah.
Where we now have the roles kind of traversed and that we've got – I can really see Rose's acumen and insight and subtlety is all Pete, but her emotional Sturm und Drang and her willful selfishness is a mother, of course. But we are all things at once, depending on which we favour.
She's emotionally like parallel universe Jackie, actually.
Yeah.
She looks bloody good, too.
That's she brings her breasts with her to this episode.
Full frontal and forward, yes.
And according to Camille, she was only 39 during filming. But interestingly enough, Cuba Gooding Jr., who Jackie cites as we've got the same birthday, Cuba Gooding Jr. was born in 1968. And with Russell's Everything is 1 Year Forward in the Tennant era, 2007 would make Jackie 39.
That very cheeky of you, Russell.
And, of course, the Cybermen are 40.
Yes. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Something I really love about Jackie and Pete in this episode is, you know, when we last saw Pete in Father's Day, Jackie's quite horrible to him.
Yeah.
Deservedly so.
Yeah, yeah.
From the way he carries on. But there's an implication that Pete's death and having to bring up Rose by herself softens her.
Yeah.
And not exactly makes her a better person because she was already that person, but gives her perspective she didn't already have. Whereas Pete's survival in this universe, which isn't the divergent point because Rose had already been bored by that stage, Pete's survival in this universe makes him more sensitive and Jackie very much still in the Father's Day mode.
Is he sensitive, though? He's still whacking a whole lot of Fanta at the kids, isn't he?
Yeah, he is dark, but I think we'll see next episode that he's redeemed a bit, you know, when it becomes clear what his actual deal is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Part of the reason I love that scene with Jackie and Rose where she tells her off is it's a masterclass from Camille, because when Rose sits down next to her, she wants to open up to this girl. Yeah. She doesn't quite know why. That in itself annoys her, and it all plays out on her face. So she's not just annoyed that this waitress wants to have a word, but she's annoyed at herself because why am I talking to you about how I like my tea?
Because self-loathing will demonstrate itself in many different ways. Mm. And the most is seeing oneself at a younger age right next to you being sensitive and open. I don't want to be feeling these things right now.
Yeah. Yes.
And how dare you make them? And also, I come from nothing. And thank you for reminding me of that.
Yeah.
There's no greater snob than those who are self-made.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, isn't it? So her
except for Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yeah. Her disdain for staff is self-hatred, you know, in many ways. Let's talk about Mickey's family.
Oh, that scene. God, Noel is brilliant. We don't deserve him.
He's so great, isn't he?
He takes a good slapping too, doesn't he? Is this the scene in the chair with the undies? Where are we?
No. So he goes back to visit his grandmother. And it's really interesting because we've never thought to ask about Mickey's family. He seems to live on the estate on his own.
Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense that the other boys that we see, even when he's in the workshop, he's definitely the beta or the delta. He's never the alpha male. And we sort of have to ask ourselves, well, why is that? And of course, he doesn't have the confidence that other children had growing up because he didn't have the examples of that.
Yeah. And it turns out that he's living with just terrible guilt over an accident that happened to his grandmother. And in fact, I find myself really warming to Rose in that scene where she explains Mickey's background to the doctor and talks about what a great woman his grandmother was and, you know, about Mickey's loss. And it's just one little moment where she's thinking of someone else, where she's not being Rose wrapped up in herself. It's nice. And it's actually a little bit horrible when the preachers kind of grab him and leave his grandmother kind of bereft, not knowing what's happened to him. It's great. She's really good. And, you know, all of that stuff early on where the doctor talks about a parallel universe being a honey trap and it's a bad thing for Rose to go and see her parents. And you kind of think, well, why are you even saying that? That seems odd. And he's so easily defeated by Rose pulling a funny face and he just eventually goes, oh, all right, we'll go and do it. But in fact, it turns out that he was right. And they will see next week how it leads to the loss of Mickey. The parallel universe is so seductive that we actually lose someone to it.
Because it gives us the opportunity to see how we can ourselves be better. And well, it gives us mindfulness. It is the Buddhist Maya. It is the world of the second opportunity or the observant world. And how often do we have esprit d'escalier? Do we have staircase wit and look back at what we just said a moment ago, an hour ago, years ago, quite often? Everything would have changed if I just hadn't said that in that moment or hadn't been a smart ass or had actually just listened to that friend or listened to that person. My whole life would be different. I can count so many times where that's happened. In this very podcast.
In this very podcast. Episode after episode. In Discovery, the Federation decides to keep the Mirror Universe secret for precisely that reason, because the Mirror Universe is presumably full of our friends and loved ones who haven't died. And for Mickey and Rose, they have a dead relative that's still alive in this universe. And if only things had gone a different way. So that kind of over the top, you know, this is a terrible, dangerous place. You don't know what you're doing. Messing with this, you can't meet your father. He's not your father. All of that sort of stuff. It seemed a bit over the top, but it does seem justified, I think.
Mm. Something I love about Noel in the first half of this episode, not just the meeting with his grandmother, which is tear-jerking, and I think it's a very smart decision to have Mickey start crying.
Mm.
Because when we previously seen Mickey at the height of despair, it was in Boomtown and he's screaming, and this is a very quiet moment instead. But we get a counterpoint to that moment in Boomtown as well, because in Boomtown he screams at Rose, "It's always the doctor and it's never me."
Yeah.
Here he says to the doctor, "It's always going to be Rose and it's never me." But again, it's very quiet when the doctor's deciding who to go after.
Because it's acknowledged and they both admit it.
Yeah.
Well, they're really horrible to him. Like the opening scene in the TARDIS, he's been standing there pressing a button for half an hour.
It's the Leela moment.
Yeah.
It's as nasty
I thought it was told. Making the magic work.
Yeah. And I know that's what they're harking back to. Mm. And that was just as, can I use the racist word? That was just as, you're a primitive person. You don't get where we come from. Whether it be a person of colour or just a person of lacked opportunity or just hasn't had our generous experiences. You haven't been lucky enough to be as smart as we are.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, they're super horrible.
I think they're awful. I hope something genuinely rotten happens to both.
Well, I mean, they lose Mickey at the end of this. Yeah. You know, they lose
because
him.
Because they don't deserve to keep
because
him.
Because they
That's
don't.
Actually it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because despite what Mickey goes through there and – fun moment on the commentary, because the commentary for this episode is Camille Noel and Andrew Hayden Smith.
Ooh.
Camille says, "Clarkie, do you think that the Doctor knew what he was doing there, and you holding that button for half an hour would send you into the parallel universe where you needed to be? Do you think maybe he was manipulating you into that?" And Noel responds, "Well, that's entirely possible, of course, because the Doctor can see through dimensions, and that's why he's been calling me Ricky since season one." Noel is a massive Doctor Who fan.
That's his headcanon.
Because he also then says, because Camille says, "How do they know that they're Cybermen?" And Noel says, "Well, Rose hasn't met them before, but in season one, episode six, she saw a cyber head in Van Staten's museum." This is literally what he says in the commentary. I love this man.
You shall be like us.
But what I so love about him and Mickey in this first episode is, despite how the Doctor and Rose treat him, when the Doctor is mourning the TARDIS, Mickey actually comes in and sits with him and mimics his body language, which is a basic psychological technique for making someone feel comfortable with you, and sort of tries to encourage him. "Oh, but we can hop back between dimensions. That's easy. We can hook that up to the national grid and get power. We can do this. We can do this." And it's just this coaxing of the Doctor. So while Rose is off thinking about, "Oh, how can I meet my dad despite the fact my best friends told me it's a bad idea and I'm arguing with my designated driver," Mickey's like, "Okay, no, you've had a massive loss here. I get that." It's like the end of last week where Mickey gets, "Oh my God, someone he loved is dead. Rose, just shut up and come on."
Yeah.
It's the sensitivity of the character, and it's something that Russell wanted to explore after Chris persuaded him, "No, keep this guy on." Russell actually sat down with him and said, "I am writing Mickey out next series, but here's how I'm going to do it. What do you think?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm up for that." So this script was always envisioned as, this is the moment Mickey becomes a hero. Actually, actually, something, Mickey, we haven't discussed, and Richard, I'll throw back to you for this one. He does end up tied to a chair in his pants.
And, of course, it's only a few months since the premiere of Casino Royale Redux.
When are we going to talk about that?
We should do a podcast.
I think we should.
When are we doing the James Bond commentary podcast?
But it is a lovely nod to, as you said, Russell really gets the zeitgeist, and you might even say he's a little bit premonitory about it. But there's... I actually think it's a take on the sadistic level of the general take on what is sauciness now. And you can really look at this against, say, the Carry-Ons of the 60s, which we really ought to discuss at some point, and how what was humorous and what was au courant then is now salacious and darker. We're getting older, but we've grown up, but not necessarily in the way that our parents had hoped.
Do you think it's like, you know, in the 80s, Nyssa drops her skirt when she leaves the program and Turlough sheds his trousers before leaving the program, and so Mickey's about to go, so they strip him down to his undies? You know, just we've only got one more chance to have Noel in the show.
I think they owe a lot to Kenny Everett and Arlene Phillips' Hot Gossip as well. Well, it's very British postcard humour. But, yes, no, I definitely believe that, again, as we've said many times, Doctor Who is at its best when it's reflecting what's going on around it, and this is definitely it.
What do we think of Noel's performance as Ricky?
It's pretty flawless in that it's, I feel, in that it's exactly what a homespun boy would be doing, is overcompensating. So, yes, it's hyperbolic and over the top, but I think it's actually a very nice counterfoil for Tennant's. And I would like to think that Noel was actually taking a little of the micturate against, our David.
With the sort of snarling and baring his teeth and things.
Possibly.
Mickey is a character who's changed so much from his initial conception, and Noel has always managed to keep a track of that and keep a handle on it. So he has this other character to create, Ricky, and he has one line to sell the fact that this is a different person.
Yeah.
What am I doing here? What am I doing there?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. In that moment, it's over the top. But it's over the top because, as you say, Richard, he's overcompensating. We discover next week what he is London's most wanted for. And, you know, it's not for robbing banks or anything like that. So, yeah, it's a performance of bravado, but from someone who is genuinely brave anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a bravado born of cowardice, but it's a bravado born of, I need to own this room. And also something really weird just happened and I still need to own this room. We've got the other two members of the Preachers as well. We've got Jake, played by Andrew Hayden Smith, who was 22!
Yeah.
No way.
And Mrs. Moore.
Oh, I think we'll talk about Mrs. Moore a lot more next week, because that's when she really gets to shine. Mm-hmm. She's really great. Jake is obviously there quite early on to see the homeless people getting hoovered up.
Yeah.
And it's amazing watching this again how much this story owes to the invasion. So the invasion, we get International Electromatics mentioned here. They're on the side of the big truck that the homeless people are going into. But Tobias Vaughan's plan was to take over the world by giving everyone a small electronic device, a music player that would eventually make a noise that would, you know, take over everyone's mind. And that's exactly the plan here. Mm. And it's a long story set on sort of a near future Earth. It really is very similar.
Yeah. And also Graham Harper specifically cites his mentor, Douglas Canfield.
Right. Okay.
As his influence here. And of course, Douglas Canfield directed the invasion.
Yeah, it's a similar style too. They both have. Yeah.
Mm. There are certain shots that Harper says, that's because that's the kind of thing Dougie did. They work together specifically on the Seeds of Doom and possibly other stories. But also that is why the Cybermen march in time. Harper said, I want that. And in order to achieve that, the choreographer, Elsa Burke, first of all, auditioned 20 actors and then whittled it down to 10 actors who could actually stomp and march. But then she got to set and discovered how restrictive the vision in the costumes were, So after Cybermen got into formation, they tied them together with rubber bands at the wrist.
Really?
Because they couldn't see each other to stay in formation, they could just use the sensation of their arm. Ah, that's how tense it should be. And that's how they stayed in that sort of bowling pin formation that they have.
We're feeling it now.
What do we actually think of the Cybermen? Oh. I mean, he keeps them out of shot or like out of focus.
Just the right way.
Yeah, until the end of episode one reveal, really.
Well, it's Will Eisner design. I mean, it is the Rocketeer. It is those gorgeous deco things, which is never far away from our thoughts. And his style, as I was trying to say before, is very 30s, 40s. And the filming, especially with the big vista pullback shots and, you know, those grand sweeping melodramatic, emotional shots. And yeah, he's deaf. It really is flawless with the direction. And that's what makes me happiest, when editing, direction, design is there. And then the actors are free to do exactly what they need to do, and they're not. They're supported, because I really probably care about the former more than the latter. Yeah.
I mean, they've gone away from that sort of 70s design and from the Invasion design with the big bun head.
Well, he did say he's really tired of that whole Halle Berry wetsuit painted silver thing, isn't he?
Yeah, so they're very much steel rather than silver. Mm. He's very definite
or
that they're
vac formed plastic.
Oh yeah, that's right. Fiberglass.
They don't feel that heavy.
No,
but no, they clunk beautifully. And, yeah. And how do we feel about the flares? Speaking as nods to the '70s,
I think it's got an anime feel to it,
because the original design had the shin pieces turned the other way.
Right.
So so they had nice tapered mod ankles. Yes, disco ankles.
Yeah, it does sort of flare out, and I'm on the fence about that. Sometimes I think the overall design is a little bit too layered, and sometimes I look at it and think, oh, that's just right. So I think it's all dependent on angles. The faces are based on the Chrysler Building,
right?
Incidentally. And, yeah, there is a bodysuit element underneath that looks like tubes, which I think is wonderful. Overall, I like the design. I miss the wetsuit a bit, because my favourite design is the Invasion design. But I get why you can't have that today. It's a bit like if you look at Star Trek, even though the Borg are based on a full bodysuit, they then cover it with layers and layers and layers of
like tubes
bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm glad we went with a uniformed look, because as the Doctor says next week, oh, they're a brand. And so, yes, of course, they look sleek, and they, you know, they look like technology you could have in your home. Like one of those shin pieces could be like an Alexa.
But I do like the idea that they are hefty and invulnerable. And I think that fits thematically with where we go next week. And one of the things that Russell said, I think Russell tended to give the designers real freedom to do what they wanted. And he said, we obviously need the head handles, because that's, you know, what the Cybermen are. And he wanted the teardrop, which I think appears first in Wheel in Space.
I believe it does.
Yes.
Yeah. And again, for that very reason of what's going to happen next week, because
the actors can't see out of the main eye.
No, but it's about – is that the reason? That probably is the reason they're there in Wheel in Space. Because it's about the way that we isolate ourselves from each other through this technology. And so the teardrop thing is, you know, about tears. And in the end of the year, we'll see an oil teardrop coming out of Tracy Ann Cyberman's eye.
Mm. She didn't get – picked up for that next season of EastEnders, did you? I'd be tearing it. Well, that's a second mortgage.
So let's talk about the cliffhanger, okay? We're at the party. It's huge. We have the president of Great Britain, Don Warrington.
Don Warrington.
Yes, big finishes Rassilon.
I was going to say, in an alternative universe, he's a James Bond. We really should talk about that one day.
And
on a podcast.
Also, he was the actor that Noel Clarke saw as a little boy and thought, maybe I can be on television.
What was he in? Department of S? No.
Rising Damp.
He was a proper hottie in that.
Yes, he was.
Yes, but he'd done some ITC stuff as well.
But yeah, much like
that voice. Yaphet Kotto, are you going to say?
Much like Yasmin Bannerman and Gisette Simon, seeing Gisette Simon and thinking, oh, there's a black woman on television. I can be on television. Noel Clarke saw Don Warrington and said, oh, there's a black man on television and he's a main character and he's sympathetic and likable.
He's really got the gravitas for the role as well. Mm. He is terrific. And when
he's gorgeous, yeah.
When he dresses down Roger Lloyd Pack's character, he's so impressive. He's really, really good. And that's, of course, why he has to be killed at the party, because he's standing in the way of the sort of his sort of cyber thing.
He's actually the chunky, beefy Obama we got before we got.
Yes.
The slimline Mad Men version.
It's funny, but every single year Russell kills the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Oh, my Lord, he really does.
Wow.
Can we get him back, Chibbers?
Yeah, Chibbers could take a year off and we could get him back to deal with the current mess.
And then in his last year, he replaces the President of America with the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Yeah, who gets killed again.
Who gets killed again.
Yeah. So, yes, literally every year Russell kills the Prime Minister, which is a tradition that I'm sad has not been picked up by his successors.
Who's the Prime Minister this week?
Charles Dance.
That's it. I don't know. I've been gone 18 months.
I have two questions about the cliffhanger. First of all, why do the Cybermen need consent exactly when they're going to control people with ear pods?
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
And well, because there's a terms of agreement.
Oh, thing
that
right.
You have to tick. Yeah. No one ever reads.
The human sent iPad still can't read, yes.
That's it. It's the EULA.
And also, when we do get to the cliffhanger, which is beautifully directed by Graham Harper, although it suffers from the Prometheus thing of, you know, you can run sideways.
Title.
What the hell is maximum deletion, given that deleting involves electrocuting you to death anyway?
That's an Auton line.
Where?
No, you remember. That's when you reverse the mover.
Yes. Yeah. Destroy maximum destruction. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, and I suppose as we don't see maximum deletion, yeah, okay, good, I'm satisfied now. But what about that gallant man at the party who is being electrocuted and so grabs his girlfriend so she gets electrocuted as well?
Because that's nice.
Both
bonding.
That's not well till death do us part means love.
They kill a lot of people at that party.
Yeah, satisfying,
isn't it?
It's great. There's no one there you want to talk to.
No.
Harper wanted 100 people at the party, and the casting agent, not Andy Pryor, but Andy Pryor's assistant, said, how about 20? Which they make work brilliantly.
Yeah, by keeping them all in the foyer.
And according to Camille, the people who owned the house, it was their family home, and they were absolutely lovely. Like, she thought, oh, you know, better be on best behaviour because
she nicked a bit of jewellery, didn't she?
A whole stone lion. But, yeah, apparently they were so thrilled for Doctor Who to be filming there. Oh. How times will change for Amy Pond's house in a few years. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Listener, at Flights for Entirety, we love a good party, and so we'll be spending the next 7 days hiding in the cupboard, drinking Pete Tyler's champagne, and trying to avoid the Cybermen. We'll be back next week for the Age of Steel. In the meantime, you can find us at flightsforentirety.com, Flights for Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find us at our Series 11 flashcast, Jodie Into Terror, which is at jodieintoterror.com, Jodie Into Terror on Apple Podcasts, and at Jodie Into Terror on Twitter, and at our James Bond commentary podcast, Bondfinger, which is at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until next time, remember that your brain is the most valuable thing in the universe, apart from Spectrox and Jethric and Argonite and Gravel. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
I love my silly tone mug. Good night.
Good then.
That
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Horrible Yorkie, was recorded on the 2nd of February 2019 and released on the 14th of April. Fans of FTE will be delighted to learn that to commemorate this episode of the podcast, Star Wars 9, The Rise of Cyberman, will be released in cinemas on 20th of December this year. Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast from a parallel universe where every beloved Doctor Who classic is... Oh, fuck.
Actually, that works.
Racist.
It's actually really racist. No. Well, the entire time vortex has collapsed. Let me say that again because I pronounced the word vortex wrong. The entire...
Oh, please let that keep.
Brendan's so good at this. Why can't we be from a parallel universe where Brendan still does the intro? The entire time vortex has collapsed and we've...